Judges chapter 8. Judges chapter 8. We are picking up right after Gideon has seen a mighty victory over the Midianites. What's interesting is that the legacy of Gideon is not done yet. Chapter 8 is all about Gideon and the things that happen immediately after this victory against the Midianites and on until the end of his life. And then Judges chapter 9 continues on with the descendants of Gideon and things that happen with them. And so we're not done with Gideon yet. And what's interesting is that we're going to see the seeds that are sown in this chapter are going to significantly impact the rest of his life and what is to come in the next generation, the next chapter. This chapter, Judges 8, highlights why Judges is such a confusing and frustrating book to many people. The characters that are used by God, the men and women that we see as we study this, they're deeply flawed human beings. We want to paint them black or white. And it's just kind of our tendency when we read scriptures. We want to say this is a good guy or this is a bad guy. But reality defies such a simple definition. In some ways, this is really necessary because it highlights the way we, mankind, respond to God's intervention in a sin-cursed world. No Christian can simply be defined as all good or all bad. Our lives are much more complex than that. When we lean upon the Lord, He can do amazing things to us. And then a few seconds later, we can fall back into the flesh and be a tool of Satan. We see that even in the New Testament with the Apostle Peter. So here in Judges chapter 8, Gideon had just routed the Midianites through the power of the Lord, and the other local tribes have joined forces to help attack their army and capture the fords of the Jordan, the place where there was a shallower or narrower part where the Jordan could be crossed. If you recall, when the Midianites began to flee, after they had turned their swords upon themselves, Gideon called out the other local tribes. And Anna, if you would go down a few slides here for me, I'll tell you when to stop. Right there. So the plain of Jezreel was where they had fought. And as the Midianites escaped, they came down south along the Jordan River, right there in the middle between Manasseh and Gad. Gad is on the other side, the other bank of the Jordan. So those folks couldn't cross unless they got to one of those fjords down there. And where, close to where the Jabbok River is, if you look down south, is where there was a ford where the Midianites could try to cross because the Midianites were from the east. Okay, and so the Midianites wanted to escape out to the east. And so they were going down that way, and Gideon called out the other tribes. He called out Manasseh and Issachar and Zebulun, and perhaps Asher was coming along too. And then as they were chasing them down along the Jordan River, he called out for the tribe of Ephraim to come up as well, which was located south of Manasseh, for them to come up and intervene and cut off the fjords so that the Midianites couldn't cross. And the Ephraimites came and they did that. And we read there at the end of Judges chapter 7, the Ephraimites captured the two leaders of Midian. These are the generals, Oreb and Zeb, or raven and wolf. Kind of interesting names, those animals, wolves and ravens. What do they eat? What are they known as?
Carnivores.
Huh? Carnivores. They eat trash, they're scavengers, right? Got those kind of perfect names for these Midianites that didn't go really and come up with their own food and their own resources. They just were powerful and went around and took other people's. They were scavengers in a sense. And that was the names of their generals, Raven and Wolf. And so the Ephraimites took them and they killed them. And so we think, hey, great, Israel's come together. There's all this unity. Well, was there? Let's go on and read the first three verses of chapter 8. Who would like to read Judges 8, verses 1, 2, and 3? Charlie.
And the men of Ephraim said unto him, Why hast thou served us thus, that thou callest us not, when thou wentest to fight with the Midianites? And they did chide him with him sharply. And he said unto them, What have I done now in comparison with you? Is not the gleaning of the grapes of Ephraim better than the vintage of Abiezer? God hath delivered into your hands the princes of Midian, Or, and Zeb. And what was I able to do in comparison with you? Then their anger was abated toward him when he said that.
Okay. And so the Ephraimites have just engaged in battle, overcome the Midianites with Gideon and his troops, got to kill the two generals of Ephraim, of Midian, as they were trying to cross. And then they immediately go to Gideon and they complain. What are you doing? Why didn't you call us to begin with when you first went to fight against Midian? And it says they contended with him vigorously. They were very angry about this. Who is the tribe of Ephraim? What's their position? No. One of the two sons of Joseph. Remember, the two sons of Joseph were given a blessing by Jacob and say, they'll be like my sons, meaning they both get a full inheritance of Jacob, of Israel. And he crossed his hands because Manasseh was the older and Ephraim was the younger and said, Ephraim will be greater than Manasseh. And sure enough, they were one of the greatest tribes of the nation of Israel. In fact, who was it that came from the tribe of Ephraim? That is someone kind of significant. It wasn't Moses. He was of the tribe of Levi. Nope, Caleb was from Judah. But there was another significant spy who was from Ephraim. Joshua. Joshua was from the tribe of Ephraim. And Joshua was the one who had led the conquest. And so Ephraim had a place of prominence because they were a big tribe, they were a powerful tribe, and Joshua had come from them. And so this won't be the last time we hear from them. They're going to rise up again as a tribe and have some issues. They were kind of the prima donna among the tribes. They thought they were really something special. First question, well, did Gideon neglect to call Ephraim to battle? Did that really happen? Go back to Judges chapter 6, look in verses 34 and 35. Judges 6, verses 34 and 35. The Spirit of the Lord came upon Gideon. He blew a trumpet. And the Abiezerites, which is his immediate family, they were called together to follow him. And then he sent messengers throughout Manasseh, which was the tribe that Gideon was from. And they were also called together to follow him. And he sent messengers to Asher, Zebulun, and Naphtali. And they came up to meet him. So, did he call Ephraim? No. Why didn't he call Ephraim? It wouldn't have shown if God was that powerful.
Well, it wouldn't have shown the picture like that God was trying to say that he was doing it all. Ephraim would have tried to take credit.
Well, definitely God had a purpose in keeping it limited. But way more people came out than God initially was going to use. Because that was the whole thing about him cutting that down. So Ephraim could have been called out. But, I mean, what was another significant tribe that wasn't called? Judah? Absolutely. What about Dan? What about Reuben or Gad or the other half tribe of Manasseh? Why weren't all these other tribes called too? Think about where was this battle? It was on the west side of the Jordan River. And it was in the plain of Jezreel. That's where the Midianites were at. Right? And so what tribes was he calling? He was calling the local tribes that were directly affected by where the Midianites were at that point in time. And so he didn't call them. He just called the directly adjoining tribes. So why was Ephraim upset? Why were they upset? Because they didn't get called. But why did that upset them?
They missed the glory.
They missed the glory. What was the issue with Ephraim? And we can tell what Ephraim's issue was by the way Gideon resolved this. Let's jump to that. How did Gideon resolve the conflict? He said, you got to kill the princes of Midian, but he didn't just say, well, you guys got to kill the princes of Midian. How did he phrase that?
He did what I couldn't do.
Hey, you know, the gleanings of the grapes of Ephraim. So you guys coming in and taking what's left over was better than the vintage of Abiezer, which was the tribe Gideon was from, which was, he's saying, hey, what we went through, I mean, the vintage of Abiezer is going through the grape harvest the first time, right? And picking off the first things, right? And then the gleanings is the person who goes in after that and takes what's left over. And Gideon gives this really nice little turn of phrase here and says, hey, you guys got your leftovers. We're better than our first helpings. You guys got to kill the generals of Midian. So what are we compared to you? That's exactly what he said. What was I able to do in comparison with you? And when he said that, their anger toward him was subsided. What was Ephraim's problem? Pride, exactly. Their pride. And it's interesting that their pride, that we have to be the best, that we have to have this position of prominence among the tribes, that was their idol. And they only let Gideon go after he made sacrifice to their idol, after he fed their egos, after he said, you guys are way better than us. It was after he said that, that they were okay with him because he sacrificed to their idol. Does that make sense? Now, what do you think about Gideon's response? Why was he so quick to try to reconcile with Ephraim? And what do you think about his response? I think we'll see here in a little bit why he was so quick to make peace with Ephraim. So I'll give you a pass on that part of the question. But what do you think about Gideon's response? I'll give you my take. Were you going to say something?
I was going to say, I thought it was smart of him to say that.
I think it definitely shows skill as a politician. I mean, it was a very smooth answer. It got, you know, the Bible does say a soft answer turns away wrath. And he gave, you know, a soft answer to them. But what I find kind of disturbing, and this is kind of the bone I pick with it, is that he downplays what was accomplished through him and lifts up what was accomplished by Ephraim. But where is God in the mix of all this? I mean, the Lord was the one who said, I will take 300 and I will set the Midianites, you know, to flight. And I'm going to win this battle. And so the only reference we see here in chapter 8, verses 1 through 3 is that, well, God gave the leaders of Midian into your hands. And then he minimizes what God had done through him. And while that may seem humble, the whole point was for this whole nation to see what God was doing, to draw all of them back to Him. And so what we see with Gideon is that he gets, by failing to bring what happened into the context of what God had done, he gave Ephraim glory rather than giving God glory. And by doing that, no one was really helped. He had some short-term gain in that didn't have to have this immediate conflict with Ephraim. But there was no long-term good that was done from this. And we see Israel's fractured. Some tribes were characterized by fear and others by pride. And we'll see Ephraim coming up again with problems and issues later on down the road. And so, and again, I want to ask this question and keep you thinking about it. Why was Gideon in such a hurry to reconcile with Ephraim? And I think we're going to see there was something else on his mind. There was something else on Gideon's mind. So let's keep on reading, and let's read from verse 4 down through verse 12. And how about three verses apiece? Josiah, Micah, and Grace. If you guys could do some reading.
When Gideon came to the Jordan, he and the 300 men who were with him crossed over, exhausted but still in pursuit. Then he said to the men of Succoth, "Please give loaves of bread to the people who follow me, for they are exhausted. And I am pursuing Zeba and Zalmunna, kings of Midian." And the leaders of Succoth said, "Are the hands of Zeba and Zalmunna now in your hands, that we should give bread to your army?" So Gideon said, "For this cause, when the Lord delivered Zeba and Zalmunna into my hand, then I will tear your flesh with the thorns of the wilderness and with the briars."
Briars.
Briars.
Okay.
And from there he went up to Kemuel and spoke to them in the same way, and the men of Kemuel answered him as the men of Shechem had answered. He said to the men of Kemuel, "When I come again in peace, I will break down this tower." Now Zeba and Zalmunna and Zalmunna were in Karkor with their army, about 14,000 men, all who were left of the army were people of the east, and there had fallen 120,000 men who drew the sword. And Gideon went out by the way of the tent dwellers east of Noba and Japheth, and attacked the army, for the army felt secure. And Zeba and Zalmunna fled, and he pursued them and captured the two kings of Midian, Zeba and Zalmunna, and he threw all the army into a panic.
All right. So, Anna, if you would go down a few slides for me. I got some more pictures here that we can look at. Actually, go back up one. One more. So this is the Jezreel Valley up there between those two black lines. Just kind of get this lay of the land. And what we're going to see, notice that there is this valley down in here, the Jordan River Valley. And so they came out this way, and because of all the mountainous area, they were coming down, going south along this Jordan River Valley. And there was an area in here where they would cross over to go along the Jabbok River to go back toward the east, which is where they were from. So they were just following the geography, going back down through here. Go on down a few more slides, Anna. Down again. One more. Okay, so here we see another map of the Jezreel Valley and the way the Midianites fled after Gideon's army came in around them. And go down one more. And we're going to see another look as they come out here from where they were at. They came down to this area here. Here's the Jordan River right through here. And they crossed over, and here is Succoth, and here is Kemuel. And eventually they're headed towards Karkor because the Midianites are trying to get away and go back to where they were from and regroup. And so the Midianites were trying to escape. And apparently the Ephraimites, even though they captured their generals, didn't get everybody. Two kings whose names were Zeba and Zalmunna. They fled. And they and about 15,000 men, that's all that were left, about 120,000 men that were fighters, swordsmen among the Midianites. And so you had 300 put to flight, 120,000. We finally get a sense of the number, how big this was. But there were 15,000 left who had crossed. And so Gideon is going after them. And he's going after them not with all these other tribes who had come in to help before they crossed the Jordan, but it's now just him and these original 300 men that were chosen by the Lord. So they hurriedly leave the Ephraimites. This, we know this happens fast because they're hot on the pursuit of these guys. I don't think this lasted days. In fact, we see, as it describes them, they crossed over in verse 4 and they were weary yet pursuing. So they had been at this now for some time and were still going. They were tired, they were hungry, but they were not giving up. So they crossed the Jordan. And now all of a sudden they're with these Transjordan tribes on the east side of Gad, Reuben, and the half-tribe of Manasseh. And they come across, as they're following the Jabbok River, they come across Succoth and they come across Penuel. All right? And they go to the city of Succoth, which was Gadites, Israelites, okay, from the tribe of Gad. They go to that city and they said, look, we just won this battle. We're hungry. We're pursuing these two kings. We're trying to wipe out these Midianites. I mean, this is a national good. And the response of the leaders of these two cities, what was it? And why did they respond that way? What did they say? Gideon says, will you give some bread to my men? They're starving. Tired.
Have you captured the two kings yet?
Their response is,
their health contingent upon their victory.
Yeah. Why did they say, we will not help you because you've not won yet? They were afraid of the repercussions. Now, you think about this. I've spent some time talking about geography because I think it's kind of important. These guys were on the east side of the Jordan, right? And the Jordan was not something you just cross any place you want. There were certain places. They didn't have bridges over the Jordan like we have bridges today, okay? Back in the day, these were significant obstacles, okay? And only at certain times and certain places could you cross. And so this is all going on. These tribes, like Gad and Reuben and the half-tribe of Manasseh, were all on the east side of the river. Where were the Midianites from? Huh? Midian, which was in what direction? Further east. They were the people of the east, as mentioned here in this passage. And so when it comes to being exposed to the dangers of Midian, who is more exposed to the dangers of Midian? The tribe of Gad or where Gideon was from? Huh? The tribe of Gad. If the Midianites were going to come back, guess what way they would come back? Right by their cities, because that is the place they would go in and cross the Jordan River. And so they were thinking strategically, hey, you're going after these kings, great. But if you don't beat them, guess what they're going to do to us for helping you? Because somebody's going to talk. Somebody always talks. What are they going to do to us? They're probably going to kill us. They're going to do something horrible to us. So to support Gideon would mean a likely payback from the Midianites if Gideon lost. Was that a good response? Was their response sin? What do you think, Charlie? You think so? Titus doesn't think so, but he was shaking his head no. But you were shaking your head yes. Why was that sin? Absolutely. It's a matter of faith in God. I mean, you can have all your logic lined out, but their equation left out the God factor. These Israelites were their brothers, and they were fighting against a common enemy. And to not support your brother fighting against a common adversary in the cause of the Lord is a sin. It's a sin of neglect. Now, let me just ask a question. What happened when Gideon blew the trumpet back in Judges chapter 6? Huh? Well, okay, that's in the battle, yeah, but initially, when he blew the trumpet in the tribes of Israel. Do people come? What type of influence did Gideon have before the battle with the Midianites? They're in Judges 6 when he blew the trumpet. God let him have great influence. I mean, the tribes of Israel were just coming and flocking to him. 32,000 men came to follow Gideon. Where is that influence now? Here are men on the other side. They won't even give him bread. Wouldn't even give him a meal. I think it's interesting. It appears to have waned, just like Ephraim. Ephraim resisted Gideon because of pride, and now the Gadites resist because of fear. He doesn't seem to have the same influence he used to. So how did Gideon respond to the people of Succoth and the people of Penuel? What was his response to them? What did he tell the people of Succoth? I'm going to make you suffer. I'm going to drag out your men, and I'm going to whip you with briars and thorns. And then he goes on to the city of Penuel, and they say the same thing as the people of Succoth. And his response to them is, when I come back, I'm going to tear down your tower. Was that an appropriate response to these people? What do you think? See some yes, I see some no.
I think he could have killed him and been justified killing him.
You think he would have been justified in killing him?
You see that often as we go through the book of the...
Okay.
These, after all, we're not worshiping God.
They were not worshiping God. Interesting. What's the problem with these people of Succoth and Penuel? What's their root problem? We talked about the root problem of the Ephraimites was pride. Fear. Do you think Gideon should have any patience with people who are afraid? Huh?
Being a leader of that many people, and Should they have given them bread? I absolutely think they should have. But just because they stand, I mean, he should. It's not really clear whether that was God's will or if he just got angry and threw a fit.
I think it'll get more clear as we keep going, but I think this is good discussion. What were you going to say, Amy?
It reminds me of David with Nabal when Nabal refused to give his army food, and then David, at first he was nice to Nabal, and then all of a sudden his demeanor changed right from drastically from let's run, let the man to go kill them all.
Yeah.
You know, from one swing to the other for just not, you know, providing food.
If you remember, Abigail came to David and gave him food and begged him to have mercy, and he thanked her because she kept him from committing a sin. Mm-hmm. And so, and that was, you know, David's response. I mean, so here's a man, it's a very similar situation, who had power to do something and was about to and was saved from it. Gideon, we'll see, was not saved from his desires. But I think we're going to have to go to this root, bigger question that we're going to come to. What is even going on right now? That, I think, is going to be a bigger... Because you see him treating the people of Succoth and Penuel one way. How did he treat the people of Ephraim when they were being difficult? He fed their egos. He was in a hurry. He was after these two kings. And he didn't have time to deal with, quote, justice and judgment then. He said, when I come back with these two kings, then we'll take care of business. Huh? He fed their fear. It's interesting, too. I don't know if there's any connection, but you know, what he's promising to do to these leaders of Succoth was, you know, exactly what happened to Christ, where he was, you know, whooped, scourged at the hands of Roman soldiers, which is, you know, humiliating and excruciatingly painful. And then tearing down that tower in the city of Penuel would be a disgrace to that city. It was obviously something that was significant to them. They sinned.
Well, what we see here, of course, is Gideon not stopping to ask God what to do. But in my defense, I just finished reading today where the rest of Israel ganged up on the tribe of Benjamin and just about wiped them out. And God told them to do it.
Yep. Yep.
And the sin seems to be, you know, you can gauge the sin of Israel. So, I mean, you know, Gideon was fighting for the Lord and at his call to, to pursue these men, and these brethren that should help him work out there.
That's.
They were fortunate he didn't kill them.
Here's the question. You hit on something that I think is really important. Where is the Lord? If we break this into two military campaigns, chapter 7 and chapter 8, where is the Lord in this second engagement compared to what we read back in Judges chapter 7?
I guess all he promised in chapter 7 was that he would send them fleeing away. Not that he would kill them all.
And we see the Lord all over chapter 7. Chapter 8, he's not mentioned nearly as much. So let's keep on reading. Pick up in verse 13. We're going to read verses 13 through 17. Who'd like to read that for us? Anna, in case you two want to split that up, one of you read three verses and one other one read the other two. Verse 13, read 13, 14, and 15, Anna. And then Casey, 16 and 17.
When Gideon, the son of Joash, returned from the battle from the ascent of Kirs, and he caught a young man of the men of and terrified. And he wrote down for him the leaders of Succoth and his elders 77 men. And he came to the men of Zephath and said, "Here are Zephath and Zalmunna, about whom you ridiculed, saying, 'Are the hands of Zephath and Zalmunna now in your hand, that we should give bread to the weary men?'" When he took the elders of his head and drank and took thorns off the head of his hand, by his hand, with them, caught the nose of the head. And he broke down the tower of the head and filled the mouth of the head.
All right. So we see he has captured these two kings, Ziba and Zalmunna. And they were able to take out the 15,000 men back in verse 10 who were left. They had snuck up on them and came around them again. And then he comes back and he's got these two kings captive. He hadn't killed them yet. And he went down and he showed the people there at Succoth. In fact, he found a young man and said, "Tell me the name of every one of the elders of that city." He got all 77 of their names. And he went in there, showed them these two kings. And then he did exactly what he said. He whipped them with briars and thorns. He disciplined them. And then he goes down to Penuel and he tore down the tower and he killed the men of that city. So he's gone beyond what he said he was going to do. He did exactly what he said he was going to do with Succoth. Now with Penuel, though, he didn't just tear down the tower. He killed all the men of the city. So he went even a step further. And so he wasn't consistent with what he said. But here he had won this victory. So if we're not seeing the Lord so present here in chapter 8, how is it Gideon didn't seem to have the same influence he did back in chapter 7? If the Lord wasn't with Gideon in the same way in chapter 8 that he was in chapter 7, why did he succeed? What?
Can
you ask me? Sure. Please. But, I mean, this is still a pretty miraculous victory. I mean, 300 over 15,000.
Because it doesn't really talk about God's direction or him. Didn't he call the other tribes that found a way to help pursue him?
He had called them, but they had left. This was just Gideon and these 300 men that were still pursuing now. And it was still pretty miraculous. I mean, the 300 men, it wasn't just blow the trumpets and crash the jugs and hold up the torches now. I mean, it was 300 men overcoming 15,000 men. And that's an amazing display of power. You know, could use the word miraculous.
Your question was?
So, is this all God's will?
Well, the greater will that Israel triumph over Midianites, that's what God saw to conclusion. That, as Sister Murray pointed out, that it happened imperfectly didn't stop the overall will of God from being accomplished.
It's interesting as to what's going on, because you know, one of the things to beware of is to beware of the power of the gifts of the Spirit without the fruit of the Spirit. And Gideon was empowered by God to do this. I mean, God had given him strength to do this. But just because God gave him strength does not mean that he always used that strength in accordance with God's will. And we'll see that time after time in Judges. People were given gifts by God, and they didn't always use them the way God wanted them to. Sometimes they would use them for very selfish reasons. In fact, that happens not only in the Old Testament, happens in the New Testament the church at Corinth, the people had been given great spiritual gifts and they would use them for their own glory rather than God's. And that's why Paul had to write those portions of 1 Corinthians about properly using the gifts in the church.
There's a verse that says the gifts of God are without repentance.
Mm-hmm.
I think. So God gives it. He already knows what's going to happen. So he's doing this in full light of what they're going to do with it.
Mm-hmm.
He decides to give it to them anyway. For the greater good.
There will be good that he gets out of all that's done, but it's not. It doesn't mean that everyone's doing it the way he wants it done, the way it should be done, in accordance with righteousness. So while Gideon appears to be victorious and gain the respect of Israel for the rest of his life, a tree is known by its fruit. And while Israel is rid of its tormentor, they don't seem to be significantly or permanently moved towards the Lord by all these events. And sometimes the worst thing that can happen to us is to get what we want. And so let's read on just three more verses. I think we're going to discover something here that's been at the root of this whole second campaign. Judges chapter 8, verses 18 through 21. Who would like to read that for us? Mary.
Then he said to Zeba and Zalmunna, "Where are the men whom you killed at Tabor? They answered, "As you are, so were they. Every one of them resembled the son of a king." And he said, "They were my brothers, the sons of my mother. As the Lord lives, if you have saved them alive, I would not kill you." So he said to Jether, his firstborn, "Rise and kill them." But the young man did not draw his sword, for he was afraid, because he was still a young man. Then Zeba and Zalmunna said, "Rise yourself and fall upon us, for as a man is, so is his strength." And Gideon arose and killed Zeba and Zalmunna, and he took the crescent ornaments that were on the necks of their camels.
Okay. So this is where we're going to finish up tonight. There's still more to go with Gideon. I entitled this chapter, as I title the different lessons I'm doing, I entitled this one Gideon's Descent. And I think we see something here that was going on that was really driving this whole second campaign beyond the Jordan. What do we learn about the Midianites, and specifically Zeba and Zalmunna in particular, in this passage? What have they done? They killed members of Gideon's family. And he mentions at Tabor. Now, Anna, if you would go up a slide for us. If you look, go back down. If you look, the area where the sea encircled there in the valley of Jezreel, if you look, go straight north of that is Mount Tabor. The Midianites did not go into Mount Tabor in this battle. That was not part of the whole battle thing that had gone on. When they were thrown into confusion, they went south. But apparently Gideon had some of his brothers that were at Mount Tabor in that area. And while the Midianites had been around in town recently or whenever, they had killed his brothers, sons of his mother, sons of his father. I believe both. Okay, his full-blooded brothers they had killed. And so the Midianites weren't just tormenting the Israelites. They were killing some of them as well. What do you make of this response when he said to them, what kind of men were they who you killed at Tabor? And they said, just like you, each one resembling the son of a king or a prince. What do you think about that? I think they recognized the connection between them. I think they probably realized, or at least at this point, knew it was Gideon's family. And Interesting, though, they call them a son of a king or a prince, but not a king. Maybe kind of a hidden insult, because we'll see them again throw another insult Gideon's way. So how does Gideon's response to Zeba and Zalmunna compare to his response to the citizens of Succoth and Penuel? What does he tell them? He tells these two Midianite kings, if you hadn't killed my brothers, I wouldn't kill you. And he doesn't just say that. He says, how does he say it? How does he say it? As the Lord lives, if only you had let them live, I would not kill you. He swears by God, by the Lord, by Jehovah, if you hadn't killed them, I wouldn't kill you. That's what he's swearing to these two kings of Israel's enemy. But yet, what had he just done to his own brothers who had just not given him a meal? Killed? Well, he killed one and beat and embarrassed the others. And so we see this weird thing going on with Gideon. He was not equitable. And what seems to be behind this rush to cross the Jordan and to go after these two kings? What is this about for Gideon? Revenge. This is no longer about the glory of God and God's calling. It's about vengeance. You killed my brothers. And we see, as we kind of look back now, we see this playing into all sorts of stuff. When he's up against the formidable tribe of Ephraim, he's very quick to placate them, give them glory rather than giving glory to God, because he's on a mission. He's on a hurry. And then he's hungry and he wants what he wants. He's all about vengeance, and these two cities of Israelites won't help him with this. And so he curses them and says, I'm going to come back and take care of you. Because he's motivated by this vengeance and anger. And he goes and finds these kings and he says all this stuff to them. And now he calls his son to come out and kill him. Why do you think he would call his son to come out and kill these kings? This is another kind of a deeper question. But what good would come from his son doing this? Perhaps more insulting, but what would that be for his son?
Hoping to pass on his rage to his son to avenge his uncle.
And a potential reign.
And
a reign, because the next thing we're going to read in verse 22. The men of Israel said to Gideon, rule over us, both you and your son, and your son's son. I mean, Gideon is seeing where this is going and what he's going to be able to do in Israel. And all the things we're seeing from Gideon kind of goes lockstep with this, and that if his son kills the kings, then everyone knows how great Gideon is. And his son will be able to say, he killed the kings of the Midianites, and just try to set up perhaps some sort of dynastic thing, which we'll see going on here later. But his son's young. His son is afraid to go and to do this. And so these two Midianites tell Gideon, rise up yourself and fall on us, for as the man, so is his strength. What does that mean? Gideon, if you're a man, you do it. So Gideon did. But what is the next thing we see from Gideon? He's finally taken vengeance for the death of his brothers. And what is the next thing he does? Verse 21.
Takes the crescent
ornaments. from their camels' necks. What's that about?
Souvenir.
It's a sign of power and prestige, and it's going to go along with what we see next from Gideon.
Yeah, but he refuses their offer to rule over them.
He does, but then he goes ahead and pretty much does it. We'll see as we get into chapter 9, and the thing that he does with the ephod, we'll see that Gideon gave some good lip service to not ruling over the people, but in all practical purposes, he does. And not even just as a typical judge, but makes for himself an ephod, which seems to be modeled. An ephod was what the high priest wore, and had the Urim and the Thummim, showing the judgment of Israel in those things. And so there's definitely some confusion. And we'll get more into chapter 9 as well as we look and see that...
his sons that take up that mantle of trying to rule, right?
Well, his sons go after him. And then the whole thing with Abimelech. Abimelech, you know what the name Abimelech means? That was given to him? Son of the king. Interesting that he called one of his sons son of the king. And that's the one that continues and goes even farther. And so we see, if we were to map out Gideon's character from Judges chapter 6 through chapter 7 through chapter 8, with kind of what we're seeing, my impression is we see this arc like this. It's like he has this ascent where he's learning and he gets right with God and he's growing in faith. And in chapter 7, this great pinnacle, and he does some amazingly godly things and worships and trusts God. And then he goes down this descent where he's dominated by vengeance and anger. He goes from a fearful, doubting man to a faithful and worshipful soldier to a smooth-talking politician to a vengeful and covetous man. I mean, we see all these things going on through the arc of Gideon's life. And what I think is important, but what's the takeaway for us? What's the takeaway? And I was sharing this with Mary yesterday as I was kind of trying to encapsulate this thought in a simple way to help you remember it. The Christian life can be discouraging to those who expect stairs rather than a stairmaster. Okay. If you stop climbing on the stairs, you stay where you are. But what happens if you stop climbing on the stairmaster? You go back down. And I think that's a good illustration of the Christian life. I mean, Gideon had taken some steps and was leaning on God, and God was using him and doing great things. But when Gideon quit looking to God and took on this power and used it for personal purposes and wasn't drawing near to God, the stairmaster life, sin nature, just takes you right back down. And we see him descend, not back into this fearful, doubting state, but he descends in a different way into vengeance and covetousness and all these other things. And so it's the Christian life requires us to continually rely on the Lord, seeking His face at all times. And when we fail to do that, we don't retain the ground we have gained. We can easily go backwards. Gideon is a prime example of that. And we're going to see, as we go on, some more behavior from him that really undermines the whole point of what God was trying to accomplish. Again, what was the whole point of this whole thing? To draw Israel back to God. That was the whole point. But we're not seeing that really accomplished in a real deep, meaningful way in Gideon's life. on a personal level or on a national level. But we see still a very merciful and patient God who will be faithful to his promises.